A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 265. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are continuing our discussion about Jekyll and Hyde. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
This was a 10-episode ITV series that ran in 2015 with about 45-minute episodes. And it is written as a continuation and sort of thematic adaptation of Robert Louis Stevenson's original novella, adapted in this case by Charlie Higson, and set in 1930s London, and set on a bigger canvas with a variety of different monsters and supernatural type creatures in what was intended to be an ongoing series.
Yes, and of course it brings us Dr. Jekyll, Dr. Henry Jekyll's grandson, Robert Jekyll, who is also a doctor, discovering his bizarre inheritance that somehow the presumably Henry Jekyll's potion has affected his genetics, so that now Robert Jekyll can, in times of stress or duress, transform into an Edward Hyde persona, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a moment. But he also becomes a sort of lightning rod. He attracts other supernatural creatures, or he gets embroiled in plots between competing organizations, one ostensibly good, one definitely bad, and it seems to bring out the monstrous in all sorts of people.
Yes, absolutely. We have Jekyll, or more precisely, his Hyde persona, being a sort of pawn in the battle between these two organizations that we'll talk about a little bit more. So stretching a little more into the series, there is perhaps something of a Monster of the Week feel, where we do have generally a different creature of some sort becoming part of the story in each episode. And Robert Jekyll travels into the countryside to explore his heritage and pursue some leads about connections to his past. And there are all sorts of weird and wonderful creatures, and sometimes sort of references to folklore, like a sort of strange version of Spring-Heeled Jack appears, for instance.
Yes, if you like that bit of folklore, that England and particularly London folklore of Spring-Heeled Jack, there's a quite nice interpretation in this show with a sort of, it's a sort of almost superhero-themed version of Spring-Heeled Jack. But as you say, Brian, he does encounter all sorts of weird and wonderful creatures. I don't think we're giving too much away when we say there's some lycanthropy of sorts, there's some blood-sucking of sorts. All these things are in there as, you know, Robert Jekyll meets and has to sometimes defeat these creatures.
Those types of things are certainly there, but they tend to do them in unexpected ways, which I think is nice.
Yes, they do different things with them, which is good. And of course, while all this is going on, we've got MIO, the secret organization in charge of monsters, doing quite a bit of Richard E. Grant shouting, I think, about trying to work out how they're going to get hold of Hyde and his secrets and use him in their battle for good. And there's all this stuff. As I mentioned the last episode, there is some stuff about Henry Jekyll's original potion. And so Robert Jekyll does take versions of the potion at various times through the show. But there's also this chemical called monocaine, which both Tenebrae and MIO appear to have in their armaments. And monocaine comes in different colours. And the comparison that struck me, Brian, as you probably know, was Superman's kryptonite, which of course originally came in different colours and would have different effects on Superman. And so here we have monocaine, and I think it's black monocaine that can kill monsters, but there's other colours that can transform them back into their human versions or sedate them, and it depends which ones they shoot them with or drug them with as to what the effect is.
Yes, there was one that forces Jekyll to transform to Hyde, one that forces Hyde to transform back to Jekyll. And there were others that are basically deadly to anyone, but Jekyll or Hyde or one of these other monsters can sometimes tolerate more than a human might. So it's sort of their all-in-one tool for dealing with these things. And they have these sort of pen guns that shoot, they're not exactly arrows, but they fire devices that inject monocaine when they hit someone.
Yeah, interesting stuff that they do. I suppose it would be fair to say that the earlier episodes of The Ten deal a lot with Tenebrae and the villainous Captain Dance. And then he disappears from the scene for a while. And I guess in the middle, we get the slightly more pastoral scenes where they go out into the countryside and meet all manner of beasties. But as you say, Brian, done with a particular slant, not the usual sort of monsters we might expect. And then, of course, towards the end of the series, we'll get Tenebrae rising again, and a major villain reappears, and there's a plot that Tenebrae are clearly involved with, and we do start to learn a little bit more about what Tenebrae are trying to do.
Yes, that's right. The threat of Tenebrae never disappears. They're certainly always there, and we're always hearing about them. But we see them in the early episodes being quite mysterious, and later on, we're starting to know more about exactly what they're doing. And their main goal appears to be to revive this ancient god of sorts called Lord Trash, which is rather an unusual name, but apparently there is some basis for that in English folklore.
Yes, I did look into this, and because I thought it was a terrible name for this series. But actually, it turns out that Lord Trash, there is some folkloric basis for this that Charlie Higson is using. I shall have to ask Mr. Jim Moon from the Hypnagoria podcast, because he probably knows more about it than I do, to fill me in on the details.
Maybe Hypnagoria can give us a Lord Trash special.
Perhaps it would. That would be great if you're listening, Jim. So it is interesting. And they have, again, taken these little bits of folklore and then used them in interesting ways, I think.
Yeah, with the two organizations, it sort of gives you a bit of an espionage feel to it, with these various elements incorporated, and Hyde being the player that Tenebrae believes will allow them to revive Lord Trash, and MIO believes will allow them to help keep Tenebrae at bay.
Yep.
And along the way, we get some nice performances from people like Amelia Bullmore and Sinead Cusack, and even Clive Mantle, who I, of course, remember as Little John from Robin of Sherwood.
Yes, we did mention last time in the first episode that the cast is really pretty good. And when these other sort of more senior actors turn up, and you think they're just going to be in the Monster of the Week episode, but actually they stick around, most of them, and I thought they were terrific. But I also thought we should mention, because we haven't talked about her yet, the actress Ruby Bentall, who is absolutely splendid as Maxwell Utterson's assistant, Hilary or Hills Barnstaple, who is this splendid 1930s sort of modern action woman, capable of fast driving and handling a firearm and useful in a tough scrape. And I thought she was just marvellous, Brian.
It was a really committed performance. It was really fun. And, you know, it's full on 1930s movie character with the hat and the glasses and that sort of gumption they would give those characters sometimes.
She is just terrific, and she warmed my heart every time she appeared. And if anybody connected to television is listening, for goodness sake, put her in a Miss Marple or something like that. Or even, if I can be allowed to go off topic for a minute, Brian, if she could time travel and join the Calendar Detective Agency that we so enjoyed in the 2007 Stephen Moffat Jekyll, where the two actresses, Mira Sayal and Fenella Woolgar, so impressed us. And if she could join that detective agency, I would watch that show. I really would.
That would be quite something, wouldn't it?
It would. But put her in a Miss Marple, please. Anyway, so we've talked a little bit about the developing plots of Tenebrae and MIO and, of course, the monsters that they recruit and encounter along the way. But I did want to talk a little bit about the sort of dual nature of Jekyll and Hyde. And in particular, I wanted to talk and ask you, Brian, about this question of what Edward Hyde or what the Hyde persona should look like. Now, here's another slight diversion. I'm a big fan of the literary essays of an English professor called John Sutherland, who writes these books about puzzles in literary fiction. And he includes one essay which is called What Does Edward Hyde Look Like? Now, I'm sure we remember from the original novella that Stevenson doesn't give us a very good description of Hyde, other than to say that there's something about his appearance which is monstrous and repellent and upsets people. But one thing I think that's clear in the original book, Brian, is that he does not look like Henry Jekyll. He's not mistaken for Jekyll.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because, as you say, it's very clear that he doesn't look the same as Jekyll, and there is something unsavory or dislikable or creepy about him. He is not someone that people tend to like or to be drawn to. People are more, if anything, repelled based on his appearance, his mannerisms, his behavior. But I don't think there was anything in the original book to suggest that he did not look human. Or in fact, I think it was sort of implied that he did look human.
Yes. Yes, I think so. Clearly that he is human-looking, but as you say, there's something repellent about him that disturbs people and upsets people when they see him.
And part of this question, I think, is because a lot of those early movies, and there are some from a number of decades ago, would tend to go for the makeup quite heavily and end up with an Edward Hyde that does not look human.
Right. As Stephen King says in one of his writings about this, that quite often the makeup artists reach for the box marked werewolf. But yes, and you know, it's interesting because of the way that actors have played him or played the two parts over the years. And we were just discussing before we recorded how right from very early days, it was a common feature for the same actor to take on both roles.
Yeah, so you have this idea, if you're going to have the same actor, but he's going to look very different, but still human in these two different personas, what will that look like? And in this version of Jekyll and Hyde, and also quite similarly in the 2007 production Jekyll, they made both versions look human, but did some changes to makeup and hairstyle, and certainly to how the actor carried himself, to make it obvious to us, the audience, that this is who we're seeing now. However, the issue with that is you end up with something where really people would recognize that it's the same person. which is not quite how it's portrayed in the book.
Yes, and it is. I'm fascinated by this. You know, as I say, if you go to the Wikipedia page for Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you'll see an image of an actor, Richard Mansfield, from a Boston stage production from 1887, where he's taking on both roles. And over the years, I mean, many famous actors have done it. And then right up to date with James Nesbitt in the Stephen Moffat version, and here Tom Bateman. And I like the way Tom Bateman does play the roles so differently. I did like that they have a little bit of transformation, that his eyes go black momentarily with special effects, and then sort of he appears in his Hyde persona, who is much more cocky and charming and seems taller and generally bigger and much more enjoys being in some very dangerous and difficult situations, which would intimidate the more gentle Robert Jekyll.
Yes, Hyde has to appear dangerous, and I think they accomplished that here.
Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly, they've given us, again, the sort of Incredible Hulk idea that when he transforms, he becomes super strong, super fast, he's almost invulnerable, he heals very quickly. Certainly it's happened in modern versions. We saw it in Jekyll, we've seen it obviously in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comics from Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill. Were there, the Hyde creature becomes much more monstrous, and that was carried over into the film version, where he was played by Jason Fleming, of all people, who we remember from a number of things. So it is interesting what you do with Jekyll and Hyde when you put on an adaptation or an interpretation of the original book.
Yes, absolutely. And I think to a certain extent, because of how society and media have changed, for Hyde to be as scary and dangerous and do the things that he does, you need to have a sort of very powerful Hyde who has sort of beyond normal human strength and so on. I think when the story was initially written, it was not necessarily needed to have those things. So there wasn't that kind of emphasis on that.
Yeah, it's, I suppose, as you say, it's the modern version to give him some form of superpowers, because superpowers are very, very popular these days. So there you go. It's all those comics I read, Brian.
Yes. So what you and I have not talked about so far for a discussion is a more faithful adaptation of Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that is set in the original period and tells the story of Henry Jekyll and Edward Hyde rather than a descendant of Jekyll. And we may have one of those coming up a little later on, but we would certainly be interested in hearing about people's favorite, more faithful versions.
Yes, absolutely. I'd quite like to add it to our sort of classic interpretations of Frankenstein, Dracula, and even the Invisible Man that we've covered. So if you have a favorite television version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, particularly one that sticks more closely to the original novella, then do get in touch and let us know. But we think we might have found one, Brian. Stay tuned.
Yes, absolutely. So I think we should get into more of our own feelings and reviews of this show. So, Eamon, what did you like about Jekyll and Hyde?
Well, we normally start with the writing, and I have to say that I like Charlie Higson. I enjoy his work on television. I'm pretty big fan of the Enemy books, his young adult books. I confess I haven't read Young Bond, but perhaps should do. So I did like his ideas. I did like the idea of bringing, Jekyll into 1930s London. I think that works well. It's interesting to wonder whether the original novella is set in Edinburgh or London. I'm not entirely clear as to which it was, but this one clearly is London's. And I like what he does. You know, he brings in a secret government agency, he brings in a mysterious dark organization. I think some of the episodes in the middle of the series, which aren't written by Higson, I found slightly more tricky to follow. But generally, in terms of the writing, I quite enjoyed it. And I certainly like Charlie Higson as a creator.
I would tend to agree that the writing is generally strong in this. I didn't have much problem with the middle episodes. I definitely liked the world building in this 1930s London that is filled with all of these rather unusual monsters. I quite like, you know, this is not a world of vampires and ghosts. This is a world of harbingers and strange black dog creatures and toads that can see the future and get that information to a person, and all of these sort of weird and wonderful things really appealed to me.
Okay. Which sort of takes us to the look and the feel of the show and the sound of the show. Certainly, I'd have to say that the sets, the location work, by and large, the creatures, I thought, were really very well done. I certainly couldn't fault the set location, the set shooting or the location shooting. Quite how they managed the 1930s salon scenes is unknown to us, but it looks great as well. And for the most part, I thought the beasties were pretty good as well, Brian.
Yeah, you know, I thought the look of this was beautiful, actually. You know, they achieved 1930s London very well. And, you know, they did the, you know, not only the locations, but the costuming, and they had their, some of the characters help reinforce that. They had a lovely version of 1930s London. As you say, Salon looked great. And the sort of strange and weird and wonderful monsters, you can see the CG in fairly obvious ways some of the time. But even then, that didn't bother me because it was so, the design was so nice. It was done in such an interesting way that I thought it was really quite strong.
Yes, there's a creature called the Harbinger in the first episode that is CGI, and very disturbing it looks, and that may have been the source of some of the complaints about the suitability of the show for children. There's a creature who I call Lobster Man because he has he's enormously strong and powerful, and he has one giant lobster claw on one arm, which for some reason reminded me of the creature in Doctor Who, the Brain of Morbius series.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But I thought that didn't work quite so well. And then there was a couple of moments when you can sort of see the claw wobbling and not looking like it's really as deadly as it's supposed to be. But certainly, you know, for the most part, the monster effects I thought very well done.
Yeah, I think it was helped by the fact that they were such, you know, interesting and different monsters that they had in there. And, you know, they would sometimes show up in unexpected places. You know, there would be someone who was just standing there, and then it's mentioned, oh, yes, we have a shapeshifter. And all of a sudden, someone is using his hands to reconfigure his face. And, you know, all of these odd sorts of things made for a really nice sort of visual language of this show.
Yes, because we haven't mentioned the shape-shifting man. We haven't mentioned really the sort of ninja minions that Tenebrae have, these sort of shadow creatures that can be dissolved. And there's some other features in there as well that were sort of, I thought, were quite nicely done in the background that we haven't really had time to talk about. Yeah, interesting stuff.
And the glimpses we get of 1880s London look quite good as well.
Yes. And of course, as you can probably tell, I'm delighted to see Dr. Henry Jekyll and Edward Hyde played by different actors. and Edward Hyde looking suitably monstrous and disturbing, but in a human, in a, you know, clearly human fashion. Which I guess brings us to talking about the performances in this show, Brian. Pretty well cast, I thought. So what did you think of the actors?
I was pleased. I thought there were some very good performances in here. I enjoyed it a lot. I think some of the supporting characters were standouts, with Donald Sumpter and Richard E. Grant being among them, being really good there. But you also had people like Natalie Gamede as Bella Charming was a really interesting character to watch. So I really enjoyed the characters and the performances in this.
Yes, any show that brings us Richard E. Grant, Donald Sumpter, Sinead Cusack, and Amelia Bullmore, really, you know, they're great to watch. I think Tom Bateman actually does a pretty good role in convincing us that he's two different characters, and clearly he appears to be having some fun when he's Edward Hyde. He looks like a character that takes this dark enjoyment in violence and action, and has that strange sort of charm, which, as you say, attracts Bella, as well as other, you know, various characters to him. So I thought he was great. Obviously, I thought Ruby Bentall as Hills was terrific, and I wanted more scenes with her. But I also loved Christian Mackay, who's a great actor, playing Maxwell Utterson. He's done a very famous version of Orson Welles, that actor, and he's lovely in this. Again, he's not in it enough for me, unfortunately.
Yeah, there were definitely some fun performances in here. It was really quite a fun show, I thought.
Yeah. Okay, what about elements of the show that perhaps weren't quite so successful for you, Brian? Were there any things that you noted in the negative column?
Well, there weren't too many, because mostly it was pretty strong. We've mentioned that some of the visuals and the computer graphics, I think, were not quite as strong as we might hope. I think it was a very ambitious show in its visuals. I did notice that they had this rigging and the stunt actors to do this effect of someone being punched and flying across the room, usually hitting a wall or something. And they used that effect a little too much, I thought. We saw that quite frequently.
Yes. Usually when Edward Hyde or one of the other monsters hits somebody or swipes them and they fly across the room to the wall. But yeah, it is TV CGI. You know, it's the best sort of CGI possible on British TV at the time, I'm sure. But it does look like CGI in places. But there you go. Those are the limitations of the show. We're sort of familiar with that from modern Doctor Who as well. And I didn't want to hold that against it too much. I did find the motivations of some of the organisations involved a bit mysterious, and clearly this is stuff that would have come out in the second series had it got one, and I don't think we're giving too much away to say that this particular show ends with somewhat of a cliffhanger, Brian.
Yes, my biggest disappointment is that there was no second series. It was clearly designed as an ongoing series, and Charlie Higson has mentioned that he intended a second series, but it's very much the story of this strange version of our world with all of these monsters in it, and these organizations competing for supremacy. And Robert Jekyll just happens to be the character who's caught in the middle, who is our central character. In many ways, the title Jekyll and Hyde is almost a misnomer, because he is the central character, but the show is about so much more than the Jekyll and Hyde story.
Yes, it is. And as you say, you know, it's a shame we didn't get the second series. I suppose one of the things that I would mention is that it was an unlucky show. I think the timing of the broadcasts was perhaps slightly ill-advised. They got the negative publicity from that. You might have thought that would perhaps push the ratings up, with children desperate to see what the fuss was about. But then, unfortunately, they miss an episode because of something terrible that happens in Paris. And it just seems like bad luck, I'm afraid, Brian, that, you know, ratings started to drop off fairly spectacularly. People didn't stay the course. And as a result, we never got to find out what some of these storylines were going to do, which is a great shame. You know, ITV trying to do something in the genre, but it just doesn't work out for them.
That's right, yeah. I quite liked how they did the ties to the original Jekyll and Hyde and set it up that this was not some distant descendant. This was the grandson of Henry Jekyll. And we meet a number of characters who have met both Henry Jekyll and Robert Jekyll. And we have a sort of quite strong connection to that original story.
Yes, I did love the flashback stuff. I did love the connections. I did love Gerson as the sort of the footman who becomes the mentor for Robert. The fact that they discover his laboratory, which clearly in this version of the Jekyll and Hyde universe is in London. So all that stuff, great. And of course, some of the other characters who we meet later on also have got these connections back to the original Jekyll and Hyde. And that was lovely as well. And, you know, particularly good actors play in those parts, which help tremendously.
I believe, and this is a bit of an aside here, I believe the original Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was set in London, but being written by a Scottish author, it was a London that, in how it was described, apparently seemed to be very much more like Edinburgh rather than London. But it was actually stated as being London in the original story.
Okay, that may explain my confusion. Obviously, I need to go back and reread the novella because it's been some time.
In the 2007 version, they did make it Edinburgh based on the way things had been described in the book.
Right, and I seem to remember Mark Gatiss turns up playing Robert Louis Stevenson, I think, in the flashback sequences there.
In the 2007 Jekyll, that's correct, he did.
Yeah. Okay, interesting stuff. And as we say, a search for a faithful adaptation of the original novella continues, but we're working on it.
So I think that leads us nicely into our recommendations. Eamon, would you like to start on this one?
Ooh, tricky. I thought you were going to go first. As our listeners might have detected, I had a few problems with Jekyll and Hyde. But as so often happens, when I get down to discussing it with you, Brian, I do sort of start to think about the bits that worked well. And I would point out that at the moment, it's a ridiculous fiver on Amazon. So if you've got the price of a cup of coffee and a sandwich to spare, pick up the DVD because, you know, as we've said many times on this show, Brian, we do need to buy this content to encourage BBC and ITV and other providers to keep making these genre shows. So maybe if the DVD sales pick up a bit, it will help them. So it's a sort of cautious recommendation based on the price of the show that I'm going to give to our listeners. Clearly, I preferred the Stephen Moffat, James Nesbitt 2007 Jekyll, although, as you said, Brian, they are, in a way, very different shows. But yeah, I'll be sort of cautious with this one and say for $4.95, if you're here in the UK and you've got the money to spare, check it out and let me know what you think. What about yourself, Brian?
Well, I will be less cautious. I enjoyed Jekyll and Hyde a great deal. I thought the world it was set in and the visuals and the way the story was told and the performances were generally strong. It was great fun. And yes, unfortunately, it ends on something of a cliffhanger and does not continue into a second series, but it's well worth looking at. So I'm definitely going to recommend this. It's one to check out.
Excellent. But as ever, you know, if you have your own strong views about this show, or if you know of other interpretations of Jekyll and Hyde that we should perhaps look at, then please do get in touch on the Facebook group or on the email.
Yes, absolutely. Or if you have favorite film adaptations or other versions that we might not cover, but that are worth looking at, please let us know. So, in summary, Jekyll and Hyde introduces us to Robert Jekyll, the grandson of the original Henry Jekyll, and he is in Ceylon in Sri Lanka, where he has been adopted and is living a quiet life as a doctor, but soon goes back to London to investigate his own past, and we learn a great deal about his own past and how he came to be where he was and so on. And we are introduced to this weird and wonderful world with all sorts of creatures and monsters, and the organization of monsters called Tenebrae, which is clearly up to doing some things that are quite evil, that will cause great harm, and they are going up against MIO, MI Other, which is a secret government organization that fights against Tenebrae and keeps the monsters at bay in one way or another. And we have this involved story that involves these organizations and different monsters and all sorts of things, and has Dr. Robert Jekyll at its center.
Splendid. And of course, please come back and join us next time, when we will be standing by for action and taking our yearly visit to the wonderful worlds of Gerry Anderson and Super Mario Nation. We're diving below the waves with Stingray, of course, from 1964 and 1965. Some special submarine adventures to discuss next time, Brian.
Anything can happen in the next half hour. It will definitely be a fun one to talk about that, for sure.
Yes, you'll be hearing us saying that a few times.
But before then, you can find us and all of our previous episodes at BritishInvaders.com. Or if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find our group there, where you can join in the discussion, where we talk about British science fiction and TV and related topics.
Great stuff. Also, British Invaders is part of the Voice of Geeks network, where you can find us and several other geek-related shows at vognetwork.com. Vognetwork.com, your place for all those geeky shows you want to listen to.
Very good. So, thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Thank you very much indeed. Until next time, it's Eamon Hyde in England saying, it's time for a change.